Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Beetlejuice.
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 It's
showtime. Welcome to The Syndicate, a film and TV podcast. Be a part of the conversation as industry insiders, genre lovers, and cinephiles dare to peek beyond the curtains of imagination and dive into the art of cinema. Join us as we want you to spend less time scrolling and more time watching. Now here's your host, Armand Haddad.
All right, so Renier, thank you so much for coming on to The Syndicate. You are the creative mind behind Horror for Kids, and today we're going to be talking about the 1988 horror comedy Beetlejuice. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit more about your channel and what that's all about.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've loved Beetlejuice ever since I was a kid, and I'm so excited to be able to talk about it here with you. Horror for Kids pretty much started when it was pretty much in the heart of COVID, and I wasn't working, and I've always loved horror. I've always been the biggest horror fan. But the thing about that was that I've always been a big chicken as well. So horror for me really stayed within the realms of like PG-13. And, So as you can imagine, I really like absorbed it. And what I wanted to do was share some of my love for those PG, G, PG-13 titles that we all kind of grew up loving and that turned us into the horror fans that we are today. And so what started off as just me kind of sharing clips of like old promos and commercials and stuff like that, the more I kind of worked two, almost 3 years into it now, it's become so much more. And I'm like, every day I'm so mind blown and so grateful to like have this platform that so many people like engage with and seem to really like for the most part. And it's just been really great. So my goal with Horror for Kids is to not create, but inspire the next generation of horror fans to love the genre that we do.
That's quite a feat. And I do have to note, you are wearing a Goosebumps shirt. I think it's safe to say that you're a 90s kid like me.
Like
we grew up, like you said, like we grew up and like there's these tangential like horror franchises that just like engrossed our lives. Goosebumps being one of them. Like you can't avoid it. Everyone read those books. I've read like most of those books, like I can imagine the covers like off, like they've been living rent free in my brain since the 90s.
It's just amazing. Like how long that stood the test of time. You're absolutely right. Like the cover of those books, just unbelievable works of art.
I was even in the presence of R.L. Stine. It's coming to me now because like he went to, we have this, it's like Comic-Con in Chicago. It's called C2E2. And I kid you not, I was about 10 feet away from the mind behind Goosebumps.
That's unbelievable.
The Goosebump himself.
That's awesome. That's so cool. That is so cool. I mean, it's like a dream of mine to be able to like even talk to him. So the fact that you were like standing right there is so cool, man. So cool.
He was telling a story. I'll be quick about this, but he was telling a story about like, he was just walking around, I forget where, just in life. And like some woman stopped him and was like, "Excuse me, sir, please don't take this the wrong way, but you look like R.L. Stein." And he was like, "What do you mean, take this the wrong way?" I am R.L. Stein, by the way.
That's great. That's a great story. That's fantastic. I work with Scholastic to give away his latest Slappy book. Well, it came out last year. And throughout that process, I was hoping to have a chance to engage with him, which like he retweeted the tweets and then he was like active on social media, but which I'm super grateful for. I was not expecting at all. But I do hope to have like a kind of like how we're doing now, sit down, chat with him at some point. That'd be just the highlight of my life.
Honestly, it might happen.
Fingers,
keep on working at
fingers
it.
Crossed.
Like that would be amazing if that happens. But I could totally see it happening. So let's go back to your channel, Horror for Kids, because like I've been following your channel for a while, and I invited you here because I was really impressed with your archival prowess of just documenting the horror that we grew up in. And even like beyond like the overt horror, like titles like Goosebumps, Are You Afraid of the Dark? But like, I remember one of your posts was The Magic School Bus. And it was this episode where I think they go to space and one of the nerdy kids takes off his helmet and his face just completely freezes over instantly. And that's, I mean, it's not a horror show, but like there are the elements of horror that are just sprinkled throughout all the childhood cartoons that we watched. And you do a fantastic job of documenting that and kind of like showing the new generation, like, hey, like, look beyond like the horror titles of today. If you rewind the clock just a little bit, horror has been sprinkled throughout all the genres, not just like the Jordan Peele titles or like the Blumhouse titles, but like throughout cartoons.
Absolutely. And like you, first of all, thank you so much for all your kind words about that. Like I really appreciate that, but you're absolutely correct. Well, here's the thing too. A lot of people think that I am this like guru of like children's horror media, and like I here's the thing, a lot of my posts I'm learning in real time, so and I mean that, like I'd say 75% of what I post is something that I've learned like right there at that time. Now of course I love to share, as you said, like the mainstream stuff and all that fun stuff, but nothing really like satisfies me more than when I can find a great piece of horror within something that it should not be in. Like, like, you know what I mean? And so I really love those moments. And I feel like a lot of our followers really gravitate towards that, because as you said, it's like, wow, horror has been sprinkled into Magic School Bus, been sprinkled into Arthur, right, into like all these like G rated television shows.
Yes.
And so that would be one of the main things I really try to highlight too.
Here's a question for you, because I want to get into your channel and like the idea behind it of highlighting horror for the youth, because I noticed that with the cartoons today or just made for children stuff today, it's lacking that element of scaring children. Because like if you go back to the 90s, the 80s, even the 70s, there was stuff, even Disney cartoons, that was terrifying. Even Snow White and the Seven Dwarves have those sequences that are pretty scary and terrifying for a child, even for an adult.
Right.
And I just wonder, like, is that element missing in like pop culture today of like scaring kids? And I think I personally think it's pretty important to have those feelings for children, because it kind of like, it's a part of growing up. It's kind of like a reflection of the world in a safe environment of watching a movie.
Exactly. You really hit it there. And it's funny, I did an interview with the Are You Afraid of the Dark creator, DJ Mikhail, and I asked him, I said, if you were to create that show today, how would that look? And his response was that he really doesn't think that he could, because of the societal limitations or restrictions that are placed in today's media, he doesn't think that he'd be able to get away with a lot of what he got away with in the 90s. And that's a reoccurring thing that I'm hearing from more and more people that I speak to involved in horror media. And it's true. Like you said, it's a reflection of today's world. And so, you know, things are changing in a way that's not like they were in the 90s and the 80s and the 70s, where you had cartoon adaptations of R-rated films, like literal R-rated films. You don't get that so much today at all. No. If you look for it, the reboot of Are You Afraid of the Dark, I think is spectacular. And I think it really kind of carries on that scare factor that the 90s possessed. It's really mm-hmm. There's three seasons of it, but you really have to kind of look for it in today's media. Whereas back in our time or even before it, it was just shoved right in our faces. You didn't have to look for it. It was right there in everything you watched. Right.
Right. Yeah. Like it's just wild to think back to, like, for example, the 80s, cause you mentioned like a cartoon adaptation of like R-rated films, like RoboCop, for instance. Exactly. Like imagine
Crusader.
Imagine today if like John Wick had like a Saturday WB adaptation. It'd be insane. Or toys, a toy line for John Wick.
Oh God, can you
with
imagine
a figure dog?
A pencil.
Yes.
That's funny. Yeah, no, it's just, you know, there's things that changed with the times and that's one of them for sure.
Honestly, I think we need to bring it back. I think we're pacifying children a little bit too much. Like, I understand, like, I mean, we don't want to traumatize children, right. But also, like, right. Where you have, like, kid-friendly horror, like, Goosebumps. I mean, they recently made that movie version with Jack Black, and I think it was 2015.
Yep.
And it had great praise. And I think it was beyond just nostalgia. I think it really resonated with the youth, so... I think there is a hunger there, but I think the powers that be are too afraid to ruffle some feathers because, you know, there's going to be Karens out there. Like, how could you put this on Disney Plus? This is terrible.
You're right. I personally would love to see more scare factors in children's media. And like, I a lot of the times you'll hear me refer to horror for kids as we, when it's really just me, but I have friends and family who all like kind of pitch in and followers now, amazing followers who pitch in. And some of my cousins who are like 9, 10, 11, 12, like I ask them like, what are you guys like geared towards? And it's not the, like the cart in terms of horror, it's not like the cartoons or like the kind of the shows directed at kids. They're more into the PG-13 and up scares now, like Megan and, you know, things that like may have been a little not too scary for us, but things that you don't expect 11 and 12 year olds to kind of be into in terms of scare wise, they totally are. And so if that's happening, I definitely feel like there's room to slide some of that into more PG and G rated titles.
Yeah, I think we could totally do it.
Absolutely.
Like with Megan, I haven't seen the film. I've seen some clips, but like Megan's a great example of like something that a young adolescent could watch. Because like I think back to me growing up and the similar film that we encountered in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s was Small Soldiers. And when Small Soldiers came out, I was definitely not the target demo. It was definitely like a mid teenager, maybe like 15, 13. I was like, I think 10, maybe younger. And there was this notion of like, oh, this forbidden fruit. Like, oh, this is like a big kid movie. Should I be watching this? And I was totally fine. I learned about the Gorgonites and the Small Soldiers guy. And like, it has a lasting
scene, right? With Christina Ricci. So like, it's fine. You turned out great.
Yeah, I turned out perfectly fine. I'm on a podcast.
No, I completely agree with you. And like that was one of my favorite movies too, Small Soldiers. And like, as we talked about, we were a little bit younger than what the demographic of that film was, yet they came up with a toy line. And I remember that because I had like half of them back when I was a kid. And I remember being like 9, 10 and going to like after school daycare, and all the kids my age had small soldiers toys. So it was a huge moment. And I do think that, you know, if Megan had come out in like the 80s, like if it was like a Beetlejuice, it might have been a PG film. Because when I went to the theater to see it, I kid you not, 90% of the theater was 12 to...
Really?
12 to, like, 16-year-olds.
That makes sense. Because, like, I was joking around with one of my friends. He's a big horror fan. And I was like, Megan is a vehicle for a TikTok dance.
Yeah,
because we all know that scene where she's in the hallway and she busts out some dance moves. I don't know the context. Maybe I'll find out one day. But like that just blew up all over social media. And that was the driving force of the marketing was that dance that she does. And who's the main users of TikTok? Huge portion of it is young people. Exactly. So, of course, they're going to be like, I want to watch the Megan movie. Exactly. Kind of like made for them, even though it's an R-rated movie.
What my next point was that here in Canada, at least it's PG-13, but the smart decision behind the marketing was to come out later on with the R-rated version. So it's like, you kind of hit both of your markets there. You hit the upcoming horror fans, you hit the, you know, the teens, the kids, and you also then build up the excitement of these scenes that were cut because they were R-rated, and you bring back in your 18-plus fans, right? So the whole campaign was just phenomenal.
It reminds me, because I know it's the parent company is the same, Universal. It reminds me of Chucky, because like we had Chucky growing up, and that was definitely not for children.
Exactly.
But we all know who he was.
Yep, exactly. Man. Chucky appeared in like wrestling campaigns, and he was it was a different time for sure. Like you would not see like you would not see Pennywise, or maybe Pennywise, but you wouldn't see like Terrifier, Art the Clown doing it.
Oh my god!
Like, you know what I mean?
So on Nickelodeon.
Nickelodeon. So it's just they were completely different times for sure.
It was a different time, but I think we're going to see some sort of resurgence in some way, shape, or form in this coming decade.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We've got the adaptation of the Gremlins coming out in May. That should be.
Yes. On Max, not HBO Max. It's called Max now.
See, I don't even think we have that in Canada, to be honest with you. I don't think we have
HBO
Max yet. We don't have a couple of things. We don't have Hulu.
Oh, man. It's behind the...
I know.
I'm going to call it the maple wall between America and Canada.
I like that.
So let's get into our main subject, which is Beetlejuice, because I recommend this to you, and you were very receptive about this. Like we were, you know, had the same thing on our minds, Beetlejuice. Growing up for me, Beetlejuice was probably one of my favorite films, and it's a PG-13 movie. Actually, I'm looking at it now. It's actually PG. If this was made today, it would be totally PG-13. There's even an F-bomb in it.
I know. F-bomb in a PG movie, right? Now, we have to remember that I'm pretty sure it was 1984 that they transitioned into what, like a PG-13 style of rating. Yes. So in 88, it was still a pretty new concept. Like people were just still kind of figuring things out.
Because like there's no... Because I rewatched this recently for this podcast, and there's no like gratuitous violence. There's no blood because it was because of Temple of Doom, which was pretty bloody. It was a pretty bloody movie. People got messed up in that movie, and then the censors were like, okay, we need something in between R and PG. And Beetlejuice, the subject matter itself, I would say, I mean, I guess it could be PG, but it's definitely more edgy of a film when it comes to like the sexual subject matter in there, and also like the lewdness of the language. That's where it was for me. I was like, this is more like a PG-13 film.
Absolutely.
Than PG. Absolutely. But I want to ask you, how did you first discover Beetlejuice?
So like you, I was a kid, and I'll never forget it because I really think it had some long-lasting effects on my life. But it was fall. It was a beautiful fall day. I'd already loved fall and Halloween and the whole September, October seasons. And Beetlejuice came on, and I knew nothing about it, absolutely nothing. But it was being advertised as a Halloween-style movie, and it was on a kids' network. And so I watched it from start to finish, and my life hasn't been the same since. From the time like that opening, that song that really kind of hypes you up, and that excitement of that, from that to like the end of it, I couldn't believe what I had just seen and was able to digest as a kid. You know, some of the things that there are some scenes in that are pretty, not bloody or graphic, but like, for example, when Barbara's holding Adam's head, or when the face pulls off, those were scenes that I was proud that I overcame and watched. And it was because of the comedy, you know, that kind of tamed it out a bit, that I was able to do so. But yeah, ever since I watched that, I was like, wow, like it introduced me to, I'd already seen horror in television, but this was now like a step towards horror in film and horror in movies. And that was huge for me.
Yeah, I mean, with Beetlejuice, like it has that horror wrapper around it, but like at the heart of it, like you said, it's the comedy that makes it more digestible for especially a young person watching this film, because I would mention this to like my peers or like people slightly older than me, like, oh yeah, growing up, like I loved Beetlejuice, you know, Jurassic Park, Jaws. And they're like, what the fuck? They're like, oh my God, I would never show my kids. And I'm like, I would absolutely show my kids this. Yeah. They can handle it.
Yeah.
Because like I said before, I think it's important to have those elements of horror in a kid's life, because with Beetlejuice especially, it kind of disarms like horror itself, because like growing up, kids are afraid of a lot of stuff. They're even afraid of thunder and lightning. People that or the dark. Are you afraid of the dark? like they're afraid of these external forces in their life. And if you disarm horror elements with comedy, like Beetlejuice does so magnificently, it makes, I think, growing up a lot easier for them too.
100%. You really said that beautifully. Like you really, that was perfectly said. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Thank you. So like with Beetlejuice itself, like we encountered it at a young age, and honestly, like it kind of like opens the door to the horror realm too, because I don't know about you. I mean, you just name drop Terrifier. So I assume that you're into the modern horror movies, and like was Beetlejuice a gateway drug to horror films?
Oh yeah, 100%. Beetlejuice like really opened the door for me. Now remember, I said that I was still a big chicken, but yes. Beetlejuice opened the door for me to handle more so, or kind of condition me into the concept of this, supernatural horror, paranormal horror, that kind of thing, where we're dealing with an afterlife with spirits in a more mature themed way. You know, this wasn't like Tales from the Crypt cartoon where like you kind of knew the ghosts were whatever. This was like, this was really happening. There were real scares happening here. So it really conditioned me. And as you said, it was a gateway drug for me to look for more of that, wherever I could find it. So like you said, Jurassic Park and all those great, PG-13 horror movies that showed, you know, scenes with a little bit more mature style blood, not blood and gore, but, you know, and from Beetlejuice, I was just super into it.
What's also interesting with Beetlejuice is the director and the composer, Tim Burton and Danny Elfman, little did we know that this would propel their career so much further, because like Tim Burton is like a brand now, and like you can see like the hallmarks of his visual style in Beetlejuice. It's definitely more muted as opposed to where it is now. Like, I think to like Alice in Wonderland reboots, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory reboot, where it's like this aesthetic that he just transposes on all these franchises. But like, you could see like the beginnings of like his aesthetic with like the angular, exaggerated architecture and like the dark themes and the very specific clothing that his characters wear, very gothic. Did you notice that as well when revisiting this film?
Yes, absolutely. Like, it was like watching like the early stages of like a genius, you know, like I pointed out like, oh yeah, like, you know what, you could see how that transitioned into this movie, or you could see how that aesthetic, you know, moved itself into this movie, or how it plays out into this film. Or, and so I really feel like Beetlejuice was like the one of the really strong pioneering movies of Tim Burton's career. And you know, just how hard he even worked to have it made once he got the script, like he, from what, like just in doing my research, you know, he was looking for a movie to do, and he was given lots of different scripts and they're all pretty stale to him. And when he came across Beetlejuice, he was so into it. And even pitching to the actors of the film, the actors, the actresses, he went really hard. And like, I think there's a story where he had to like fly out to meet with Catherine O'Hara to even pitch it, because she wasn't into it. Oh, so wow. He had to really like pull these strings to make it all work. So I really feel like Beetlejuice is like one of his firstborn babies.
It truly is, because like I'm looking at his filmography right now, and he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure. That was his directorial debut. And you could see, I mean, it's definitely not a horror film, but there are horror sequences when he loses his bike.
My bike!
Like, you could see like he's been like itching for like a horror film, and like he finally got that a few years later with Beetlejuice, and that just like that set into motion the rest of his career. Because like after that, you know, he did Batman with Michael Keaton, who plays Beetlejuice. He then dons the Crusader cap to play Batman, and it's like, oh my god. And he did Edward Scissorhands afterwards, and you could see, I mean, I dare I say, I think Beetlejuice is probably his magnum opus. I think
he
struck while the iron was hot, and he just made a masterpiece.
I agree, a masterpiece. And you know, it's funny that you said Batman Returns with Michael Keaton, or Batman with Michael Keaton, because they were actually supposed to do a sequel, an animated, or I forget if it was animated or live action sequel to Beetlejuice, called Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. I'm not sure if you ever heard of that. Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure they have a poster and everything for it. It was in development, and because of how kind of distracted Tim Burton and Keaton were with Batman, they kind of didn't have the time for it. But there was apparently like a script, and the wheels were in motion. There was a whole plot line of the Deets moving to Hawaii and trying to build a hotel. And the hotel was built on like a Hawaiian spiritual burial ground. And so the movie is Beetlejuice versus this Hawaiian spirit in like surfing competition.
Oh my God.
So yeah. So take that how you will, but it was in motion. I'm not sure if we'll ever get a chance to see it, but
I'm just glad that didn't happen.
Most people that I tell that to are. I would just kind of want to see. No, you know what? I don't think I would want to see it, because I think that people's reception to it would tarnish the Beetlejuice name. But it would be like a car accident that, like, you know, like you can't really take your eyes off of. Like, just the plot line alone is just so far-fetched. And apparently, like, the whole, you know, strength of the movie was going to fall behind the clashing culturals of, like, Hawaiian culture and this, like,
God.
German themed U.S.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Don't let your intrusive thoughts win. I think there's a reason why it never came to fruition. Because, like, we have those tiki elements in Beetlejuice properly, because when he goes to the underworld, he encounters, like, a voodoo shaman, I guess.
Right. The witch doctor, kind of.
Yes, exactly. So I could see where the train of thought began. It's like, oh, well, you know, he should fight the tiki god in Hawaii. It's like, no. Let's take a step back, everybody.
That's exactly it.
Yes. Yeah, so we're getting into the plot. So Renier, I want you, could you, for the listener, summarize the plot of Beetlejuice 1988 before we really dive into what this film is all about?
Absolutely. So the plot line of Beetlejuice are, there's a couple that is recently deceased, and the movie is pretty much about them dealing with the effects of the afterlife, and a family moves into the house that they've lived in, and they're trying to get them to move out. So to do so, they enlist the help of Beetlejuice, and not really realizing how maleficent and how kind of mischievous this spirit is, that kind of backfires on them, and that is a quick, brief summary of it. And you know, the movie really deals with themes of like death and like the afterlife, and that for a kid was just really kind of new to see it being done in that depth, and like to see the scene of like, you know, the in the first 15 minutes, the two main characters, Adam and Barbara, like drown essentially.
Yes.
That was really big, you know? And so that was really cool at the time. And actually in the script, I know I'm kind of going off topic, but in the script, that scene of them drowning was going to be a lot darker. And I really wish Tim Burton kind of leaned in on that a little bit more, but in the script, like the car kind of crushes Barbara's arm, and they're like screaming as they're drowning and like flailing their body parts. Yeah. And so, I mean, I wouldn't want to see that played out in full effect, but I do think that there's other parts like that that are darker and that could have made its way into the film.
I think so. Yeah, let's get into it. So like, the couple that were introduced to, the Dietzes, right?
Dietzes, yep.
Played by Alec Baldwin and
Alec Baldwin and Catherine O'Hara.
Yes. So I was okay. I think it works better if they didn't do the whole gruesome route, because like it works on a suspense level, because like we don't really see them die. It's kind of implied. And when they return to their house, they're soaking wet. So we assume, as you know, if we're watching it for the first time, that they're home now. But little do they know is that they're dead. So like we're finding out with the characters that they're actually, you know, they crossed over and now they're kind of stuck in their home and they become ghosts within their own home.
Absolutely. You know what? Now that you said that, I do agree with that more. I think that was such a pivotal part of the movie and so early on that really captured your attention that I will go. I'm not sure if I'd want that removed and to have seen them die so graphically. So I give you that. That is very good.
Because, like, I mean, as the horror fan within us all, we want them to, like, scream and, you know, drown, and we want to see it. But, like, storytelling-wise, I think it works better if we're left in the dark and what exactly happened. Because, like, when I was watching that crash, it's a bit comical because, like, they're, like, suspended. And like this stray dog or somebody's dog is like holding the car up because like he's like perfectly balanced on like the piece of wood, and then he moves and the car falls into the river. Watching that, it's like, oh, surely they're not going to die. They're going to get out. And we didn't see them get out. Oh, they got out. They're wet. Oh, they're dead.
Right.
Oh, some other family's moving in. They don't want them to move in. They have to scare them away.
That was such a great pivotal. Like that's what really like, if the opening theme song didn't capture you, then that part definitely should have.
Yes. And what's interesting is like, as I was watching this, like growing up, I didn't think I registered in my kid brain that they were dead for some reason.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I think it was because I didn't see them die. I was like, oh, and then I just thought they were just weird. Like the Addams Family. I was really into the Addams Family.
That sound was great too.
And like, I would ask like my mom, because my mom introduced me to Addams Family, and I'm like, are they dead? She's like, no, they're just weird. And I was like, ah, which is true. They're not.
You want to spell the plot for you.
So with Beetlejuice, like, it's just a beautiful film because, like, we have all these weird, interesting characters. We have Beetlejuice played by Michael Keaton. And for a kid watching this, like, I was absolutely drawn towards Beetlejuice because, like, he's this larger-than-life figure. He's this weirdo. And there, you just, like, you shouldn't like him because he's truly the villain. And he's, like, a con artist. He's like a used car salesman for the underworld. And we shouldn't like him, but there's something so charming about his character. And I think it's all to Michael Keaton's performance from start to finish with this film. Oh,
absolutely. What Michael Keaton did with Beetlejuice was just unbelievable. And the origins of how it came to be are just so fascinating to me. Like how he was the one who came up with the look of Beetlejuice. It wasn't even Tim Burton. Tim Burton had no input. All Tim Burton did was tell him kind of what he envisioned and said things like, oh, he look, you know, he comes out of a rock, or like he his finger, his hair looks like he stuck his finger in an electric socket. Those kind of things. And then Michael Keaton took that and went to V. Neil, who was the makeup head, and they came up with this Oscar award winning look, right? And
oh my God,
that to me is just unbelievable. And like, yeah, so like, not only is, you know, the charm and then the appeal, not only did that work for everyone, but the makeup effects and the prosthetics and the whole. The whole visual of him and the things that he could do and say, all those things like are what made that character so unbelievably iconic.
I had no idea this film was an Academy Award winner for its
makeup. We're talking about an Oscar award winning Beetlejuice here. Absolutely, yeah.
I didn't know
we
were living in the timeline where Beetlejuice is an Academy Award winner.
Yes, I believe they also won like 3 Saturn Awards for also like best horror film, best makeup, and there was one something best visual or something best audio.
Well, like it makes sense because part of the film does take place on Saturn, as you know.
There you go. But yeah, this won an Oscar for how awesome it looked, so that really has to say something, you know?
You know, okay, like Tim Burton, good for him. Because, like, he not enough credit is given to Tim Burton because I think because of his long-lasting legacy. Because, like, we look at Tim Burton's like, oh, it's Tim Burton. He's a great director. But, like, I think, like I said earlier, like, he became more of a brand name. Like, when you think of Tim Burton, you think of a certain aesthetic and a certain directing choice rather than him as a person, him as a creative force. And I don't know when that transition happened, but like young Tim Burton versus the Tim Burton now are like almost 2 different people. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. There's been a lot of growth there, for sure. And, you know, even in the styles, like it shows, like as we were talking about earlier, like some of his earlier films, they're like little like rough drafts, like blueprints of like what's to come.
Right.
And just to see how they've played out in modern day now, you know, some of them aren't as scary, but still there's horror elements in there. And you can at the very least see the core of the aesthetic that's still there.
Absolutely. Like he's.
Yeah, it has a brand name. Yeah. Now essentially like how many other directors, there's maybe like a handful of them that you can say, okay, look, you can look at one clip from a movie and say, this is their movie. Solely based on how it looks.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You know what? That's a hallmark of a great director, where you can just look at one single frame, one sequence, one scene, and be like, I know who that director is. That's a Tim Burton movie. I could think of some other directors. Alfred Hitchcock.
Yep. That's a great one.
Maybe Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Bay. Here's a negative one. Explosions. Robots.
Orange filter.
Oh, that's a Michael Bay movie.
That's a Michael Bay film there.
Oh my God. But like this movie, to go back to Beetlejuice, like this movie like covers a lot of interesting ground when it comes to the themes of the movie, because like we're following this couple as, you know, it makes me as the viewer think about my mortality. And like, I mean, I don't know what happens after, we'll all find out when it happens, but like a fear of mine is being stuck in a temporal place, like being a ghost in a haunted house, essentially. And that's what these main characters that we're following, that's what they become. And it's like, they don't want this other family to come in and change their home. It's like, this is my house. You get out of my house. So like a big portion of the first act and a little bit of the second act is them trying to scare away these newcomers.
Yeah.
And we get that great scene of singing Deo.
Deo. And like, that I think, again, was another scene that cemented how iconic this movie was for me, because being of Caribbean background, that was the first time I've ever seen like Calypso and like soca music being played in a mainstream movie. And so for me to see that and be like that was just so mind-blowing to me that they included that. And it was actually Catherine O'Hara that suggested it, because they were going to take a more R&B route with how the soundtrack was going to play out. It was Catherine O'Hara that said, let's go with Calypso, and look at how that played out. Tim Burton actually didn't even like that scene at first with the dinner table. He didn't even like that scene. He thought that it wasn't funny. And it wasn't until like the test screenings that people like really resonated and kept talking about it that he said, okay, you know what? Now I see why it's so good. So like, this was just,
oh my God,
all the stars falling into place to make this such a great movie.
This is an example of lightning in the bottle. We have the right people at the right time working on the right project, because I can't even imagine Beetlejuice with an R&B soundtrack. It just would not work.
Yeah, can you imagine, right? That's so like, and it's that contrast of the somber and gothic tones of the movie, the aesthetic of that mixed with this lighthearted, fun Calypso music, that you got this clash of just awesomeness.
And it fits thematically too, because like with the island music, like you said, with the witch doctor character, that the mysticism lends into the overall theme. It points to the theme of like the supernatural, the afterlife, you know, the beyond, beyond the material world. So it just makes sense that, I hope that's what Catherine O'Hara was channeling when she even mentioned like, oh, why don't we just do Calypso music instead of R&B? Because like R&B soulful music, and you know, I think of like Disney films like Aladdin or Beauty and the Beast in the end credits where they have the R&B cover. I could show you the world. I can't imagine that with Beetlejuice. Can you imagine R&B music with Winona Ryder dancing on the floating at the end scene?
That's what it was supposed to be. That was the scene. That was supposed to be an R&B song. Literally, yeah.
No.
Literally,
yeah. It just, exactly. That doesn't work. That doesn't work at all.
It doesn't work. Speaking about that scene, another cool thing about the script was that she was actually, the concept of her getting the grade and then kind of levitating, I think she got like an A or an A+, and then levitating with the spirits. Yeah. That was supposed to be a scene in which she was engulfed in fire, in flames, and she died. And then she celebrated that death And the movie was going to end with her being a spirit with Barbara and Adam. So that's how the script had it, which I think is pretty dark. Pretty dark. That each, why it was changed was because they ultimately didn't want to show that or portray death to be happy.
Mm.
So they kind of switched that. They didn't want to show, you know, PG-13 or PG watchers that this was a happy way to die.
Right.
They changed it. But yeah, that was the original script.
It would have became an A24 movie at that point. The Witch.
Literally, that's a scene from Hereditary. Yes. That's funny. That's exactly it. Yeah, they would have definitely had to relook that rating for sure.
God, yeah, if it was rebooted today, it would take a darker route. Well, probably not, because like there's been a Broadway adaptation of Beetlejuice that has been massive success.
Massive, which just goes to show the pop culture impact of this movie. Oh, yeah. It's planned out to an animated series, a Broadway musical, countless video games, like just huge, huge impact.
Yeah, and even a cartoon on WB, I think, because I watched a little bit of that.
I was wondering, I was like, did I see the animated series? If not, definitely talking about the animated series. That was amazing.
Did I imagine that?
Yeah,
I, like, I think it was on Disney, actually. I don't know where it was, but. Yeah. Definitely seen. I was like, Beetlejuice as a cartoon?
Oh my god. And like, even as recent as 2019, Beetlejuice, I think 2019 or 2020, Beetlejuice was in the Halloween special of Teen Titans. Like, as Beetlejuice. It was a phenomenal cameo. I posted it on Horror for Kids. It's so good.
Oh my god.
So we're talking about like the 80s to 2017, like, or 2018, or one of those. Sorry, 2019. I think it was 2019. From the 80s to 2019, that span of like just relevance to pop culture is incredible.
Like Beetlejuice had that staying power of that legacy of influencing pop culture, but like it definitely came back into the zeitgeist around that time because there was talks of a sequel happening. Beetlejuice 2. Right. I mean, it's apparently still in the talks.
In the talks, yeah. I think did we get a confirmed cast member, or was that a rumor?
I honestly
remember seeing Jenna Ortega might have been confirmed, but I don't want to record on that. I think it could be a rumor. I don't know.
I think it's a rumor. I think we want it to happen. I mentioned to one of my horror friends, I was like, yeah, you know, Jenna Ortega was like in talks of being Winona Ryder's daughter in the Beetlejuice reboot, and he was like, oh, that's god, right. No. I was like, come on, man.
I don't think I'd mind that. You know, like, I think a lot of people are kind of starting to, not that they don't like her, but she's in a lot.
She's getting too
big. She's in a lot of stuff. Yeah. And so, but I do think that like following the trajectory of like her being in horror franchises and her being in like the Addams Family franchise now, the next natural step would be for her to be some way involved in the Beetlejuice franchise. So we'll see if the sequel comes to fruition.
I think it'll happen.
Do we want that?
I think it'll happen.
Yeah.
Like, I think I think, honestly, you know what? I'm just going to come out and say it. If it was going to be anybody, bring back Winona Ryder, bring back Michael Keaton, but like have Jenna Ortega be that new generation for the if they're going to turn it into a franchise, or if they're just going to do like a Beetlejuice 2 Undead Boogaloo or something.
Well, that would change a lot, because then you wouldn't have to include that, like her. You can use somebody else, you know?
But right.
Interesting.
Yeah, because I'm thinking like to the Scream franchise, what they did with Scream, and it's like they made it work because they had a interesting, likable character, new generation coming in. I'm afraid if it takes the right creative force, if you're going to do a Beetlejuice, you know, reboot or remake or sequel, that the cast has to be good. And I think Jenna Ortega, if she's involved, will definitely help.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. I feel like she would be a very, very, very strong cast member. My only concern, and like, it may even be a stupid one, but my only concern would be like, are we giving this poor girl too much on her plate? Like to be a, you know, to do Wednesday, to do To do, what else? I'm trying to blame that. To do Wednesday, to do all the other Scream, to do all the other franchises, huge franchises that she's a part of. Are we giving her too much to now carry on this iconic role or be introduced as a new character with a whole new path?
Honestly, I would say no, because I think she's actually getting too big for Scream. Because Scream, I mean, if you've seen the new ones, like they're awesome movies, but like you could see that it's still a low budget production.
Yes.
So like,
Scream. That's a whole other episode. That'd be good because you can look at Scream's use of celebrities in the past and how they dispose of them. So they might kind of play that up for the next one. I love the newest Scream movies. I love all the Scream movies. I have Scream tattooed on my arm here. But I do feel like the next one, I don't know. A couple of people shouldn't have made it out of 6. So I don't think they'll make it out of 7. So we'll see.
Well, we know 7's coming. But like Jenna Ortega does not need Scream at this point. Scream needs her. So I think she easily be choosy and be like, you know what? I was offered Beetlejuice, so you need to like kill my character off.
And that would make a pretty. Oh, she already had an opening scene in the. So I don't know.
We'll find out.
That'd be good.
We'll find out. But I want to touch. I want to go back for just a tiny bit about like
Beetlejuice.
What?
Go back to Beetlejuice.
I want to go back to Beetlejuice because like you mentioned the original ending had. Essentially Lydia self-immolates and then join the underworld. I think it's interesting that they didn't go that direction because of the context of the time. So it's 1988. You probably know this. There was this satanic panic happening in America. So like I could totally see like the powers that be. I think it's Universal or I think it's actually Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers are probably like, listen, we can have a creepy movie. But we can't like glorify death because like all the PTOs are going to come after us. So I could see maybe that's in the back of their mind why they went the direction of like her dancing on the staircase floating.
Oh, totally. That's exactly why. Now, I actually didn't know about that satanic panic, but I just assumed that I read that it was because they didn't want it to, as you said, glorify that death.
And I find it interesting, like, if this type of story was made today, they would totally go for that ending, as we could see with, like, A24 movies, where you had that dark.
If Beetlejuice was out today, it wouldn't be rated PG, so they'd be able to have a little bit more creative freedom as to what they could show. And I definitely feel like they could incorporate that for sure.
Oh, yeah.
As well as the scene where Beetlejuice, we don't see the face that he makes towards the Maitlands, but we know that it's a grotesque one because we see the back, but we see all that kind of stuff coming out. They actually wanted to show that, and I think V. Neil had even made up the face for that, but for some reason that was cut too. But yeah, they'd be able to show all that and make it really good.
Honestly, less is always more.
Yeah, like that leaves it up to your imagination, right? Because especially as a kid, you're like, wow, what did they see that was so terrifying that they couldn't even show it?
Beyond your imagination.
That's the scariest stuff.
Truly. So we're okay. Actually, I want to talk about one thing before we get off the fence and for this film. I find it interesting, like looking at it through the lens of an adult watching Beetlejuice. I find it interesting that. So Beetlejuice himself is a con artist. He's trying to take advantage of recently deceased people for his own gain. And he's like I said earlier, he's a used car salesman of the underworld for his services. I find it also interesting that concept of like cheating people is also contrasted with this new couple coming in because like they're business people trying to escape the city the city life of New York to go into Connecticut, quiet, peaceful life. They're condo developers. And the company that he works for wants to essentially redevelop the entire town, the small town that he's in. Like, oh, we could put like this amusement park and shopping center and this museum over here and parking lots. And it's like, oh, you're no better than Beetlejuice.
I'm so glad you brought up that point, because Beetlejuice came to be when the studio realized how the world reacted to Poltergeist and how well that did. And so what they wanted to portray was, it's not the spirits that are the bad ones, it's the people moving into the house. Mm. They're the bad ones. So that flip is what kind of inspired the film to be. And yeah, it's really interesting to see those characters develop, and like, you almost kind of like, you kind of pick sides as to like who you're cheering for, if it's Beetlejuice or if it's the family that's moving in, or if it's the Maitlands. And you know what's great about that concept and about this film too, is that I find as I grow and as I age, there's different things that resonate more with me, and I, you know, like as I'm in a relationship now. It's like that scene where they crash the car and die, and like the theme of that, like, you know, anything could happen, is really terrifying. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And like, and having to navigate the afterlife with your significant other, that's a whole other concept than what you're envisioning as a kid. You know what I mean? So that's just a true telltale sign of a great movie. Like, the older you get, or kind of not even with age, but with different stages mm-hmm. of your life, it resonates in different ways.
We all take something differently depending on what age you approach this film. Because like, as a kid, you'll be like, oh, this is a wacky, fun movie. And then as an adult, you're like, oh, like, you look deeper. And it's like, you see the subtext and like, you apply it to your own life and you react to it. I think that's a hallmark of, honestly, more than a film, this is art that we're looking at.
Art, yes, absolutely art. And like, even, like, art in every sense of the word, in every department, the soundtrack was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
The visual effects, the makeup effects, the acting, the stop motion, all that was just so well done. And as you said, it was like lightning in a bottle, like all just this collaboration of talent and people putting their minds together to create this masterpiece. It was just phenomenal. One of the coolest things that I think, the title of the movie was supposed to be called House Ghosts. And then, yeah, House Ghosts was the name of the title. And then they changed it. Tim Burton had jokingly suggested that they call the movie Scared Sheetless. And the studio was like, yeah, you know what? That's pretty good. And Tim Burton was like appalled, just in horror that they were even considering it. So they came upon the name Beetlejuice after a star, I believe. And yeah, that's how it all came to be.
Oh my God. You know, so I work in the creative field, and it's always the option that you least like that the stakeholders go with. Hey, why don't we go Scared Sheetless? That's great. Oh, shit.
That's so funny. Yes, that was his exact reaction to it, too.
And I think most people would be like, oh, well, anyways, but not with Beetlejuice, because like, this doesn't happen a lot. But like, when you have that project that all the right people are associated with, and they all believe in the project and they give it their all, you could tell. I mean, Danny Elfman making the soundtrack, which it's amazing, iconic, and like, it's an earworm every time you hear it. It's like, oh my God, like, this is an amazing theme for this movie. And then Tim Burton with his direction, and then the whole creative team and the actors, and it's like, everyone gave it their all, and that's why they got an Oscar.
And it shows, exactly. That's why I got an Oscar. You're
absolutely
right. You're absolutely
amazing. Right. So, Renier, are you ready to get off the fence on a few questions regarding Beetlejuice?
Absolutely. 100%.
Okay. So my first question is, you know, we've been talking about like sequels for years now, before the pandemic. So do you think this film even needs a sequel at this point?
I would love a Beetlejuice sequel, and I'll tell you why.
Lay it on me.
I would love a Beetlejuice sequel because I run an account for kids' horror, and I really feel like kids today would really, really love a modern version of Beetlejuice. I would want to see what that even looks like, to be honest with you. And I feel like Michael Keaton wants to do it. Tim Burton wants to do it. Winona Ryder wants to do it. So, like, that passion is still there. It's not like you're begging these people to come back and you know, that passion is still there. And I'm curious to see how Beetlejuice has evolved from the 80s to 2020s. Like, that's like a time capsule. Like, you know, like one of those time capsules that you put underground and you open up and like 20 years. I would be so excited to see what that looks like now. And I really feel like the opportunities for like marketing and promotion, like the return of Beetlejuice, like that would be so cool. It would be like a Pennywise thing, like every 27 years, like, you know, like Beetlejuice is back. Like that would be the coolest tagline. You know? And I think that would really bring in a lot of people. Now, I don't know about the story. I hope it doesn't follow like that Hawaiian plotline, but I would really want to see what, you know, that tale would look like in 2023.
Honestly, I wasn't excited, but having listened to you, what you just said about seeing it in the 2020s, like, even though I absolutely love Beetlejuice and the charm of the practical effects and the stop motion, I think that's what really makes Beetlejuice special, is that use of like practicality with it. Because like, if it was made, you know, the sequel, it would totally be like CGI. Like, I'm thinking of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory compared to like the original one. I was just like completely CGI. But who knows? Maybe there will be practicality involved with, if they were to do a sequel. If they know what I mean, that seems to be a resurgence. Like, we had the CGI fest, and now people are like, oh, you know, I like models. I like rubber and silicone in my movies. Let's bring it back.
Yeah, and I think it was the brand that really is hammering that home. People all over, like, on all of my posts about, like, behind-the-scenes things, people are all the time saying, bring back practical effects, special effects over CGI, special effects over CGI. Like, they're really, really into it. I think that the voice of the internet is being heard by all different kinds of studios, and they are bringing it back. Now, the great thing about in 2023 now too is that, as we talked about, we'd also probably get like a PG-13, maybe even like a 14A Beetlejuice, which would open up the door to so much more. And that's a part of why I'm so excited, or why I would be so excited to see.
Yeah, I think 100% it's going to be PG-13. Even Star Wars went the PG-13 route with the new films. I think it's a safe bet. I think it's a safe hedge to make it PG-13, because then you'll satisfy everybody, including, you know, adults. So I think that's the safe route to take. Do you think it's going to be rebooted by Netflix? We're not going to get Beetlejuice 2. It's going to be called Beetlejuice, a Netflix original.
I really hope not. And I'll tell you why. I love Netflix. I have Netflix literally playing in the background. But, you know, there's something about, like, a movie premiere. Like what Megan had, you know what I mean? Like, and, like, you know, people have a lot of negative things to say about the movie experiences and whatnot. But at its core, there's something really special about seeing something on the big screen on opening day or opening weekend, and having that premiere and there being the promotional cups and the popcorn buckets and all that stuff. Netflix has its own pros, but it can't deliver that experience to you. So that would be what I would want for Beetlejuice 2. I would want that. And, like, you know, like, it's part of, like, I wish that Hocus Pocus 2 had come out like in theater instead of on Disney Plus, because then we would have had so much more to it, right? But that's my opinion. I really feel like Beetlejuice 2 would benefit from that marketing that goes into a major motion picture that's, you know, premiered at.
Absolutely.
the box
Well, you
office.
Can blame Bob Chapek for that, for the Hocus Pocus 2, because, oh my God, he got fired for a reason, because he cooked the books when it comes to Disney Plus, and he wanted to put everything on Disney Plus, and obviously it didn't work. But yeah, that's why I didn't see Hocus Pocus 2. Like, I absolutely love Hocus Pocus, the original. I've been watching it like countless amount of times since I saw it as a kid. And yet, when Hocus Pocus 2 came out, I wanted to see it. But if it was in theaters, I would have went.
Yeah, of course. And that's so unfortunate. Like, that's so, that's just, and see, that's what I don't want for Beetlejuice 2. I want it to be seen by like the exact same audience that would have, you know, gone to the theaters in the 80s or whatever. Now is going to take their kids to go see that movie.
Yeah, like, I think, okay, it's definitely going to have a theatrical run. Like, I could just imagine the marketing, like, similar to what they did with Megan, with, like, having the Megan dolls everywhere. Imagine having Beetlejuice with a striped suit. Like, it would be amazing.
Halloween that year would be the best year ever. Every kid, every single kid would be green hair, mold on the face. It would be a vibe.
Remember 2025? Yeah, man. That's when Beetlejuice came back.
I'm telling you, like, we're onto something here. We should be a part of the marketing team, because it's this kind of passion that needs to go into it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, we're talking about Beetlejuice here, like the Oscar award winning Beetlejuice. It needs to have that.
It needs to have an event.
That type of, yes.
Like Star Wars when it came back in 2015.
Yes. Exactly.
Yes. It needs to have an event. So do you think this film...
And then if Netflix wants to make a TV show out of it, then whatever they want to do with it. But let us have that movie premiere.
Yes, if HBO Max wants to reboot it as a 10-year TV show, The Beetlejuice, all right, we're here for it.
There you go.
All right, so I think I know your answer to this. Do you think this film stood the test of time and it's a cultural piece of cinema?
You know my answer. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of my favorite films, but even being unbiased, like, it's an Oscar award winning movie. So, like, it really encapsulates all of the best of the best. As we've spoken about for the past hour, the visual effects, the makeup effects, the soundtrack, the storytelling, the directing, all of that has come together to create this masterpiece that has worked for decades and decades, literally, right? Like, we just, as I said, we saw a version of Beetlejuice and Teen Titans. And so, like, people, there's still a real fandom for Beetlejuice. You know, you go, like, even if you go to Spirit Halloween, they still have Beetlejuice from the 88, like things from the 80s, like Beetlejuice, you know, like, towels and stuff like that. People still love it. So I definitely feel like it has stood the test of time. It's one of those movies that you can look back on and be like, oh, you see, like, they did that then, but they couldn't do that now. And, oh, that it really has that, like, nostalgic factor to it. You know what I mean? And so it's and then you mix that with, like, the fall vibes and, like, the Halloween spookiness of it. You've really got yourself a masterpiece.
Like, yeah, I mean, people clown on Beetlejuice, like, oh, Beetlejuice? Yet we all know about Beetlejuice. Like, there's a Broadway adaptation of Beetlejuice that was a huge hit. Like, we're all yearning for a Beetlejuice sequel. Like, honestly, like, this is the 35th anniversary of its release this year, and we're still talking about it. We had an entire podcast talking about how great this film was and how it works and how it could still work today, and it resonates so well 35 years later. And yeah, I mean, I totally think this is a cultural piece of cinema. Like, it's interesting that it's this film, but, like, everything about it just works. You wouldn't think that this would last almost 40 years later, but it does. And it just, we all love it and we can't get enough of it.
Absolutely. Can't get enough of Beetlejuice. And, like, but like we said, it's still super relevant in today's media and, you know, it's a classic tale. Like, everybody who's our age, or, you know, even younger or older, knows about Beetlejuice, or has heard the term Beetlejuice, or knows, like, you say the word three times, Beetlejuice appears. It's kind of got, like, that Candyman style, like, folklore to it. You know, like,
it's the kid version of Candyman.
Stuff like that. for a long time. Kid version of Candyman. Absolutely. You know what? You lean into that. You can really get some really spooky themes out of that, you know?
Because he truly is the kid version of Candyman.
Yeah, the more I think about it, the more it's hitting me too. Like him, like I could totally see him coming through like a wall and like offering, you know, candy and all that kind of stuff. that'd be really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I can just imagine the sequel or reboots or remake of like just Beetlejuice today. Like it'll work. Like imagine seeing the snakes on that desert planet of Saturn with today's technology. Yes. It would be fucking awesome. It would be like Dune level stuff.
Amazing. Yeah. That's what I want to see. That's what I'm here for.
It's a cultural milestone. We got to see the sequel, reboot, whatever it is, the new version. It's going to happen. Yeah. But would you recommend Beetlejuice 1988 to a friend?
I would recommend it to all my friends. I'd recommend it to all my family members. And I would definitely, I love posting about it on Horror for Kids because it like, it's right on the threshold of like, it's right at my limitation. It's right at that like PG-13 level. I have a lot of fun with it. And like, I just learning about kind of the behind the scenes trivia and stuff that went into the movie. It's just so fascinating to me. And I, you know what, it's funny, like I'm my career job is a makeup artist, and I got into makeup because I wanted to do special effects, and I truly believe it stemmed from what I would see as a kid in Beetlejuice and all my favorite horror movies. And I mean, now I'm involved in like fashion and TV, but I started because of my love for horror movies, and I it's movies like Beetlejuice that really inspired that. So now I try and post about it to hopefully inspire the next generation of people that want to get kids that want to get into special effects, makeup or animation or stop motion or directing or that kind of stuff.
Well, I think you're doing a fantastic job. And I think with your channel Horror for Kids, you're definitely inspiring the new generation because like ultimately like kids, I mean, I felt this way too growing up, like looking back to the 80s, I didn't live in the 80s, but I'm like, oh my God, everything was so much better back then. Movies were better. Cartoons were better. Everything was better. Culture was better. And yet Gen Z or Gen Alpha are looking back to the 90s. And they're like, oh my God, the 90s were awesome. And I'm like, the 90s? Well, I mean, I'm a little biased because I'm a 90s kid. But like, it's just wild that the generations that keep on coming always look back a decade or two and are like, oh, I wish I lived during that time.
100%. But I do think that 90s kids are a unique brand of children though, because we saw through older siblings and older cousins the 80s and how life was then. But we were also on the cusp of seeing the pioneer lifestyle of this new age too, of the internet and social media. And we're young enough to engage with that and still have Snapchat or TikTok accounts or know what that is at the very least. And so we're a very unique group we're the best. Yeah. We're the best. And we can really kind of touch on multi-generational topics because we kind of experienced a little bit of it all. Whereas kids born in, you know, I've got siblings who were born post 2000 who, you know, they don't know the 80s. I had to introduce them to like Are You Afraid of the Dark and Goosebumps and whatnot. But and a lot of their friends who don't have older siblings, they don't know about all those shows. So it's like 90s kids.
You're doing the Lord's work by introducing these kids to awesome horror media. You're doing a great job, man.
You know what? Even on like a deeper level, like I genuinely, like from the bottom of my heart, feel like, like even outside of what I do in my career, Horror for Kids, when I die, is going to be what I leave here on Earth for my future generations to hopefully want to continue. And like I feel like this is my contribution to like planet Earth, is showing, introducing kids to horror.
That's awesome.
And so I'm happy with that. And if that's how I go out, I'm more than I'll be doing it till the
day I die. Man, you're definitely leaving the world in a better place than how it was.
I'm trying. So are you. Your podcast is awesome. Like, well, what you guys cover is so cool. And like, even going through some of your old podcasts, like, you guys have covered such an extensive
thanks, man.
Amount of movies that range from all over. So congratulations Thank to you too. You're doing a phenomenal Thank you, job. Man.
I really appreciate that. But like, yeah, I mean, your channel is gaining a lot of traction. You had a Bloody Disgusting was featuring you, and you know, Are You Afraid of the Dark? Talking to you too. I mean, you're definitely getting the notoriety and recognition you deserve because you're doing a great job.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And yeah, I'm really hoping to do more. I love when like authors reach out to me and are like, you know, like, can you help me promote my book or whatever? And I'm like, of course. I love to put out as like, that's what the whole account's about. It just so happens to have now like 80,000 followers and a platform that I can, like, I want to help people put out their children's horror media. So like, it's been working really great, and I'm having a blast with it. Everyone over at Bloody Disgusting is phenomenal. I hope to work with them so much more. Fangoria, I've worked with them before in the past. They're great. So like, I just hope to continue this and hope that it keeps growing and growing, and we'll see awesome. where it takes us.
Well, congratulations. So before we sign out, where can people find your channel, Horror for Kids?
You can find Horror for Kids on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. It's at Horror, the numerical 4, Kids. We are not on TikTok. there's been some accounts that are using our profile what? Picture, and they're this is something that it's something that's really upsetting. But like, they're using our profile picture and posting Whoa. Content that is not for kids. Like, it's not really cool.
Take
but
that
like,
down.
We are not on TikTok. We are on Twitter. We are on Instagram, and we are on Facebook.
You should send over a cease and desist.
I've been trying for the past like 2 months to have the account taken down ever since I was notified of it. Actually, and the most embarrassing part is that like, it was actually like one of, I think it was like Scholastic or somebody that I was like, I was doing a partnership with, and they're like, we want to like tag you on TikTok, but this content doesn't seem to be like it's yours, or like, but it's your profile picture. And I'm like, what? I'm like, I don't even have a TikTok. What's going on? And so I look, and it's like, oh man, they're showing like, cartoon like nudity and all sorts of things that does not align with my brand at all. And so I've been trying to have it taken down. But yeah, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram are where you can awesome. Find Horror for Kids.
Well, I'll link that Thank in the you. Show notes of this episode. Not TikTok. Screw that guy. Well, Renier, thank great. You so much for coming on. This was a blast talking about your channel, also Beetlejuice. This was a great time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thank you so much for having me. I had so much fun. This is one of my favorite podcasts I've ever done. I've done a few now. This is definitely one of my favorite ones. I had such a great time talking with you. If you ever want to do this again, feel free to contact me. I'm 100% down. You can pick another movie and have a great time.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, I hope everyone checks out your channel. You're doing a great job over there, and hopefully we can do this again soon. Thank you so much, Renier.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
All right. So let's close this out. Thank you, everybody. See ya.
That's it for this time on The Syndicate. We hope you enjoyed yourself. Keep the conversation going by adding us on Instagram and Letterboxd at Syndicate. Or join the Discord server where you can catch Armand along other podcasters and listeners at syndicate.com/Discord. And until next time, stop that scroll and spend more time watching. Goodbye.